Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. Searches, Selfhood in the Digital Age, by Vauhini Vara. The book cover has a still-life painting with many objects in it, such as a vase of flowers, a bowl of pastries, a black tea kettle with a long spout, and a glass filled with a red liquid. It is embedded in a background of grayed-out paragraphs of words. The reviewer is Dwight Garner. A memoir of what AI giveth and what it taketh away. Searches, by Vauhini Vara, is both a memoir and a critical study of our digital selves. There is a photo of two hands holding a digital camera, reviewing a picture of a close-up of a woman's eye and eyebrow. Vauhini Vara was in high school when she learned that her charismatic older sister, Deepa, had a type of cancer called Ewing sarcoma. The cancer went into remission and Deepa left to study at Duke, where she took an interest in public policy. Her cancer came back in her junior year. Deepa returned to the family's house in Mercer Island, a suburb of Seattle, close to where her father worked as a physician for Boeing. Vara took a leave of absence from her freshman year at Stanford to be with her sister. Within a few months, Deepa was dead. "You have a memory to look back on today," Facebook likes to creepily tell us. For Vara, Deepa's death is the memory that needs no reminder. It is one she cannot shake. It marked the beginning of her expulsion from Eden. Her parents soon divorced, and her family, as she'd known it, ceased to exist. After graduating from Stanford, Vara turned to word work. She was on the staff of the Wall Street Journal, covering Oracle and Facebook, and then she joined the New Yorker to write and edit for the business section of its website. She wrote two books of fiction, the novel The Immortal King Rao, which was a finalist for the 2023 Pulitzer Prize in Fiction, and a story collection, This Is Salvaged. For many readers, she is best known for a piece of experimental writing titled Ghosts, in which she used an AI chat box, a precursor to ChatGPT called GPT-3, to push her sister's story past the usual boundaries. Ghosts ran in The Believer in 2021. It was anthologized in the Best American Essay series and was adapted for audio by This American Life. Ghosts moves in mesmerizing fits and starts as Vara feeds GPT-3 her own sentences and asks the Borg to pick up from there. At moments, it is as if she is moving a heart-shaped planchette across a Ouija board. What spooks Vara is that AI writes what are possibly her essay's most piercing lines. "Here, then, is something else," one paragraph begins. "We were driving home from Clark Beach, and we were stopped at a red light. And she took my hand and held it. This is the hand she held, the hand I write with, the hand I am writing this with." The awkward fact about these intolerably beautiful sentences is that this event never happened. GPT-3 served it up a la carte. Vara writes, in sentences that drive her new book, Searches, Selfhood in the Digital Age, "I'd often heard the argument that AI could never write quite like a human precisely because it was a disembodied machine. And yet, here was as nuanced and profound a reference to embodiment as I'd ever read. Artificial intelligence had succeeded in moving me with a sentence about the most devastating experience of my life. If it could write that sentence, what else could it write?" Searches is a complicated and many-sided book. In part, it's a memoir, one that pays special attention to Vara's early years on the Internet in the 1990s. She was born in 1982. She recalls trying on different identities and the anxiety-inducing sounds, a long, staticky screech punctuated by a series of sharp beeps as if the machine were hyperventilating, of dial-up. Paul Allen, a co-founder of Microsoft, lived in Mercer Island, and Jeff Bezos had a house in a neighboring suburb. Vara's coming of age felt inextricably linked with the tech world's own. This sense doubled when she arrived at Stanford in the fall of 2000. Larry Page and Sergey Brin had just dropped out to start Google. Stanford was a third campus to get a sexy new website. Facebook and Vara edited the first article about it for the Stanford Daily. Sam Altman, the wonder boy of AI, was a freshman when she was a senior. Many of Vara's friends went on to work for one or more of these prosperous companies. Threaded through the story are short, sharp sections that, for example, list her searches on Google and investigate her order history on Amazon. She is as sickly addicted to the latter as I am. Will the company send flowers to our funeral services? She lingers for pages over the dark sides of these companies and of Facebook and her complicity in their successes. Is it possible that everything the internet gives you, it takes back twice over? Picking up from her experiments in ghosts, Vara feeds chapters of this book to a chat box as she goes along, asking for feedback, and she prints its responses and paraphrases. Some of the replies are smart and uncanny, but there is no way around it. Reading AI summaries of and commentaries on what you have just read is, after a while, a pulverizing bore. Perhaps a better phrase is terrifying bore. AI's language is a sort of dead but high-flown managerial bureaucratese, the sound, you begin to feel, that our digital oversouls will make when condemning us to death. Searches has many things to recommend it. Vara has a congenial style and her nose to the zeitgeist, good stories to tell. The book's word-drenched cover is exceptionally beautiful. All the same, the book is diffuse. It has little forward momentum. Most of its wisdom feels conventional. She is down the middle about so much. The gifted novelist, Tony Tillithamat, who is unmentioned in this book but who attended Stanford at roughly the same time Vara did, is also preoccupied with exploring what he called, in his 2016 novel Private Citizens, the obscene entitlement of a Stanford degree. So hallowed are our elite universities that Paul Fussell, writing in his book Class, could not help admiring the cheek of the young person who cut apart the letters of a Stanford rear window sticker so that they read Snodfart. Searches might have profited from more of that sort of mischievous humor. At its best, though, Searches projects a lonely intelligence that, facing off against the machines, leaves you with a singular case of the dreads. The reviewer, Dwight Garner, writes about fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and the book world writ large. He believes that humor can sharpen an opinion and brighten an observation, and dislikes reviews that contain too much plot summary, and values honesty and straight talk. Friends of the Museum by Heather McGowan. The book cover has four actors in costume. A woman and a man have their hands on each other's throats and face. Another man is pulling out his hair, and the fourth actor is smiling mischievously. The reviewer is Joe Hamia. Brevity in fiction has its merits, but sometimes a narrative actually needs to be a doorstopper to achieve what it sets out to do. Heather McGowan's third novel, Friends of the Museum, clocks in at a dense 480 pages and opens with a cast list to help readers keep track of its 50-character ensemble. The conceit is clever. Set over one day in a New York museum during the 2010s, McGowan's plot details the inner turmoil and professional calamities of the institution staff as they prepare for the evening's Met-inspired costume gala. The author seamlessly translates the perennial ironies of the Metropolitan Museum's Costume Institute fundraiser into fiction. The theme of McGowan's event is 150 Years of the Bohemian, Outsiders Looking In. And in the words of one visitor to the exhibit, "It's crazy to celebrate anarchy at a party where the tickets go for $2,000. We open at 5:30 a.m. with the director, Diane, and her general counsel, Henry, discussing the murky provenance of a Shiva statue and its potential legal consequences for the museum. Diane is preoccupied with the breakdown of her marriage and the threat of losing her job after bungling the museum's finances. Henry is preoccupied with his own mortality after receiving a terminal cancer diagnosis. They soon pivot to a case of food poisoning that has incapacitated 11 employees at a board member's retirement party. By 8:14 a.m., we also have met Clive, the head curator of European paintings, whose mind frequently wanders to his strained relationship with his ailing father and Berlin-bound best friend, Benjamin, whose first day on the job as a film curator is marred by the encroaching urgency of paying $8,000 of debt, the conservator, Iona, whose concern over the legitimacy of a prominent donor's marble statue is overlaid by a family that drives her to drink tequila for breakfast, Catherine, a costume curator who juggles gala planning with deciding whether to abort an unplanned pregnancy, and Shay, the chief security officer, whose early-onset dementia leaves her determined to find a suitable mentor for her nephew while she endures microaggressions doled out by her predominantly white colleagues. If that sounds like an onslaught, it is. McGowan exploits the potential of her workplace setting with ruthless precision, the museum staff offering endless possibilities for socio-political commentary, interpersonal dalliances, economic hypocrisies, and questions of cultural legacy. The problem is, there's no time for the reader to luxuriate in them. The novel's pace matches that of its character's hellish workday, which is fun in theory and fatiguing in practice. Across the short timestamp sections, plot points pile up quickly, beat after perpetual beat. It's all easy enough to follow, though one gets the sense McGowan has refined everything perhaps a little too neatly. A potential donor to the museum describes it as an antiseptic mausoleum that's hostile to people of color. There's very little in the book to contradict this, but few of us need a 480-page novel to show us that the arts have failed to bring society together. One look at X distributes proof of that concept forcibly and for free. McGowan's prose is solid. Her one-liners effortless and political observations sound, if run of the mill. All fine, but wasted potential is always a sad thing. With characters so thorny and a setup so fun, the novel's politics should be anything but straightforward. Another 480 pages might have allowed for the scope of a more radical or imaginative look at how our cultural institutions and their guardians ought to work, rather than satirizing the very obvious ways in which they fail. It's time to be brave about publishing longer novels. The reviewer, Joe Hamia, is the author of the novels Three Rooms and The Hypocrite. El Niño by Pam Muniz Ryan, illustrated by Joe Cepeda. There is a bluish gray and white drawing from the book showing a boy and a girl with fins for legs swimming underwater over an underwater city. There are kelp waving and seals and dolphins swimming in the distance. The reviewer is Bonnie Choi. Swimming to a mythical island called California, Pam Muniz Ryan's El Niño combines magical realism, climate fiction, and coming-of-age sports tales. When we are confronted with the loss of someone we love, grief can suddenly hold all the other aspects of life at arm's length. Left unchecked, and what may appear at first to be a slight remove, can grow into a deep chasm of despair and sadness, or maybe an ocean. In El Niño, by the two-time Pura Belpré medalist Pam Muñoz Ryan, 13-year-old Kai Sosa, a talented athlete, is trying to return to competition on an elite swim team 2 years after his beloved older sister, Callie, vanished at sea while surfing near their home in Southern California. Callie, a record-breaking high school phenom, had always been Kai's North Star, and swimming was their shared passion. With many questions about her disappearance still unanswered, Kai is doing his best to carry the family torch. But he's plagued by self-doubt, wondering if he even belongs in the water anymore. Kai's father, who was an accomplished college swimmer and spent countless hours helping Callie with her training, steers clear of the pool now. His mother, a marine veterinarian at the local aquarium, worries that her son has not processed his grief. Only his little sister, Abby, seems to want to talk about Callie. They both see her in their dreams. Strange things start happening in their waking life once the two younger siblings find an overdue library book that Callie checked out 6 times. It tells the myth of Califia, one of an ancestral line of 12 warrior queens tasked with ruling an island of great riches named California. The Queen Califia of the story discovers that her island is sinking and saves her people by transmuting them into merfolk, capable of moving between land and sea. Even underwater, though, Queen Califia's realm is vulnerable to outside forces that threaten its most valuable treasure, a library that holds the world's sorrow and suffering. The first time Kai goes surfing after reading the book, dolphins appear around him, including one with distinct moon-like markings, who seems to want to tell him something. A pair of gold cuffs described in the story gave an eerie parallel in 2 bracelets Callie inherited from their great-great-aunt Califia, her namesake. During swim practice, the new coaches, Dominique and José, focus on Kai with unusual intensity to the annoyance of his teammates, who think he hasn't earned his place. Oddly, practice includes lectures on undersea topography and dolphin communication. One afternoon, Kai overhears Dominique cryptically describe him as the heir apparent, who doesn't have a clue what we're up against. What does that mean? Did Callie believe she was ascended from Queen Califia? Does she need Kai's help? Where has she gone? And is she really gone? An inventive, absorbing novel that blends elements of magical realism, climate fiction, and coming-of-age sports tales, El Niño features drawings by the Pura Belpré honoree, Joe Cepeda, who also created the cover art for Ryan's historical novel, Esperanza Rising. I love how the chapters are interspersed with passages from the library book about Califia, and how Ryan takes inspiration from existing origin stories about California to establish a rich, complex world of her own. It's a world that makes space for feelings, especially sad, difficult ones, and holds them in precious regard. Tears born of heartbreak wend their way to the sea and into the caring hands of the library's guardians, where they safely stay until their original bearer is strong enough to retrieve them. We do get to visit the underwater realm, but the quick dip in and out is somewhat abrupt. By the time the real action gets going, I won't reveal too much here, but the catastrophic storms that occur on a 2 to 7 year cycle in the weather phenomenon known as El Niño may or may not be related to epic underwater battles for the future of humanity. We're already hurtling toward the end. The last quarter of the novel left me with a sense of unsatisfied longing. Ryan has imagined into being such a vivid, intricate place that it's a shame to spend so little time in it, especially when there's more unpacking to be done. It's like a riveting movie or television series that concludes with an ambiguous cliffhanger, setting the stage for a sequel or second season. There's no indication that El Niño is anything other than a standalone book, But I, like our protagonist, will keep hoping Callie comes back. The reviewer, Bonnie Choi, is the author of Why We Swim and the picture book Sarah and the Big Wave. Her new book, On Muscle, The Stuff That Moves Us and Why It Matters, is out this week. 3 Edge of Your Seat New Thrillers. The reviewer is Sarah Lyle. This month's books deal with disturbances in people's minds, in their families, and in the heavens. In Sarah Easter Collins' Things Don't Break on Their Own, published by Crown, Willa Martinwood has been haunted by the disappearance of her 13-year-old sister, Laika, for more than 2 decades. One of the manifestations of Willa's restless obsession is that she sees Laika everywhere, even at the dinner party that begins the story. She could be anyone, Willa tells another woman at the table. I mean, she could be you. Part of the book takes place at this queasy-making gathering where the guests drink, trade freighted remarks, and reveal more than they intended. And part takes place in the past as Willa and Laika's monstrous childhoods unfold. Their father was violent and sadistic, especially towards Laika. I should have looked after her, Willa thinks later, and he seemed suspiciously unbothered when she vanished. At dinner, talk turns to the treacherous fallibility of memory. It's truly extraordinary how easily the human brain can be tricked into believing it remembers something that didn't happen, observes Liv, a psychologist. Even on a simple level, we can have wildly differing memories of a single event. It's clear that this line of thought is far from theoretical, and that the key to the mystery lies in the murky recesses of the past, which takes on more prominence as the story goes on. There's a murder here, and it happens when you least expect it. Second book, House of Glass, by Sarah Pekkanen. You're going to wonder what inappropriate book is concealed inside the jacket of Anne of Green Gables, which creepy Rose Barclay, age 9, is performatively pretending to read in Sarah Pekkanen's House of Glass, published by St. Martin. The first word isn't Anne, says Stella Hudson, the weirded-out narrator, who spotted the subterfuge. It's the. The bad seed? The exorcist? Our imaginations run wild. It's only one of the disturbing things about Rose, who hasn't said a word since her nanny plunged to her death from a third-floor window. Her rich parents have stripped the house of all its glass, even replacing the window panes with acrylic. But Rose seems to be amassing broken shards and other potential weapons in her room. As the lawyer representing Rose in her parents' divorce, Stella has to help determine who should get custody. Why anyone would want it is another matter. But soon she's also investigating the nanny's death and turning up unsavory facts about this very odd family. Her own traumatic childhood should put her in prime position to get inside Rose's head. The characters wander along the perimeter of believability. They include Rose's super uptight mother, her philandering father, and her overly protective grandmother. The sentences are short and portentous. The plot is lurid. The revelations are bold. Anxiety and similes stalk the pages. Do the others not feel the darkness wafting through the house, snaking into the corners and curling around us like smoke? Stella asks. All of which is to say that if you like some light familial terror, this book is pleasantly diverting. It's also not too taxing. If you fall asleep mid-sentence at the beach and wake up 5 hours later, you can still pick up right where you left off. Bright Objects, by Ruby Todd. The year is 1997, and dark excitement and dread have suffused the small Australian town of Jericho. For the first time in more than 4,000 years, the spectacular St. John Comet is scheduled to blaze across the sky, bringing wonder and fear in equal measures. Sylvia, the grieving young widow at the heart of Ruby Todd's gorgeously written Bright Objects, published by Simon & Schuster, has a special interest in the comet, which appears to be a fictionalized version of the real-life Hale-Bopp comet. When it appears, she plans to kill herself. The book asks big existential questions about fate, the cosmos, and the thin membrane between life and death. Is St. John a portent of doom, as so many believe? Certainly it's causing a stir. The comet seemed to be revealing us all to ourselves and to each other in our various registers of fear, hope, and hubris, Sylvia thinks. Though the book cranks into an unexpected, thrillerish gear towards the end, the mysteries here aren't showy. Will Sylvia find out who drove the car that killed her husband 2 years earlier? Will meeting a new man, the mysterious Theo St. John, the astronomer who happens to have discovered the comet, be enough to restore her to her axis? And just how dangerous is Joseph Evans, a local man who appears to be going off the deep end, dragging his increasingly fanatical followers with him? Mostly, the suspense has to do with how people bear the heavy burdens of love, guilt, grief, and mortality, all mysteries of a more universal sort. The prose burns bright. The reviewer, Sarah Lyle, roams around the Times, writing news stories, features, and analyses for culture, books, and sometimes national, international, and business. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.